You're listening to Rosie Cole's Vaudeville Broadcast. This program may contain adult content, so if you're under 18, please either get permission or switch it off. Hello, this is Rosie Cole with this week's broadcast, and today I am talking to a very exciting new company called Tangerino, the founders of which are Lil and Kitty. Hi guys.
Hello.
Hi.
So, do you want to say a little bit about what Tangerino's about to get started?
Kitty, you start.
So, Tangerino is a company specializing in events for circus, performance, illustration, art, and music. We started up a year ago. We're doing our third show in a week, but the idea of the company is to provide a platform for young performers in the visual arts, basically.
Yeah, because I go to a circus school and Kitty goes to art school, so a lot of them in the beginning were our friends, basically, people that we'd known and we'd studied with. We've sort of started off on a small scale with very small venues, and we're sort of steadily getting more bigger.
Yeah, so we aim to be quite site-specific in our shows. So Tangerino takes on a new space, normally in London. It's an urban events company as opposed to something outside or rural. And we choose a play to adapt within that specific new space.
It's really cool. So obviously you just said you go to circus school and you, Kitty, go to art school. Where did that come from? What is your kind of earliest memory of wanting to go into something artistic?
Well, both of our parents are artists and business people, but first and foremost I'd say they're artists. And our aunt Nell has a circus, a traditional touring circus in the Cotswold called Gifford's Circus, and that's probably one of my earliest memories of watching a performance that I really loved and wanted to be part of. And I think that circus is really all inclusive because you can sing and you can dance and you can act and you can, I don't know, swing on a trapeze and walk on a tight wire. You can do all of those things, and it's not exclusively singing or exclusively Shakespeare, or you know, you can have a bit of everything in it.
Yeah, it's a really genre blending kind of performance.
Yeah.
This is one thing I'm really excited about with circus as well, and that also kind of ties into the cabaret scene as well. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to start this podcast, was to talk to people like yourselves and in genres that, or modes of performance that kind of defy the traditional. So, you know, most people expect to go out and see a play or a musical, and they'll be dancing in the musical, they might be dancing in the play, but it's within this wider framework. Whereas events companies like Tangerino and circus companies, particularly now, that are drawing inspiration from other genres, are making some really exciting stuff.
It's really important. There's been a huge push definitely within the school I am at, which is called the National Centre for Circus Arts, to make circus a legitimate art form, you know, because it has always been considered a little bit lowly somehow, that you just sort of go and sit there and eat your popcorn and get shouted at by clowns and sort of quite roundly abused. But actually, sort of more modern circus has taken on a whole new being, really, and it's really exciting to be part of that and to be able to sort of help that along somehow.
For sure. There's definitely something I want to come back to a bit later in the podcast, talking about our perceptions of circus and why you think now things are coming to that point. But before we get to that, I want to know a bit more about you two, because if I did not make this clear, you guys are sisters. It's just like, Lil and Kitty, they're here. So, obviously circus and performance and arts run in the family. So why did you two decide to work together? Because siblings is kind of...
yeah,
it's going to be an interesting collaboration.
But we do actually work incredibly well together. It feels like whatever one of us can't do, the other can.
The yin to my yang. Yeah. Whenever one of us is hungover, the other one's totally on the ball. So we make quite a good team, don't we?
Yeah, and I think because for me, seeing a circus at an early age, the last thing I was thinking was how can I be involved in it? But physically, I definitely didn't want to be dancing in it, but I did definitely want to be part of making the set look beautiful and, I don't know, working out how the costumes were as great as they were in Gifford Circus, for example, or the Moulin Rouge when I was little. I remember being fascinated by seeing the girls look so glamorous as a result of their costumes. But so with me looking at it from the visual side and Nil understanding the physical side of it, I think that's what makes it a good collaboration.
And we've had quite a lot of sort of influence for that because our grandfather, Peter Rice, was a sort of costume and set designer for theatre.
He was a theatre designer,
theatre
yeah.
designer. And
our grandma was a textiles designer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always been somewhere in there. And I've always liked doing sport. I never really thought I'd end up doing circus. But we've only just started living together, really, in the last sort of 6 months, year or so, living even in the same city in the last 2 years, really. So I guess that's slightly how it came about now, rather than 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Because we are now in the same city, and both sort of...
And the idea of Tangerina came about because I had a project at my art school, which is London College of Communication. I wanted to... my course was graphic and spatial design, and it was all really hypothetical. It was just, if you had a space and you could design it and put something on in it, what would it be? And I wanted to actually do it for real. And luckily, I had Lil studying 3 miles away in Hoxton with lots of amazing contemporaries. And so we decided to, her and her friends wanted to try out their acts in a public space rather than just within the school, and I wanted to take on the space and design it. So we came up with the first show, which was called The Ugly Duckling.
That's really cool. It sounds like a really organic way of working.
Random,
like,
yeah.
Where you just kind of like...
Organic's a nice way of putting it. I think random. So. But yeah.
It's just kind of, you know... being able to say, oh, I really want to do this, and other people saying, oh, I really want to do this, and your objectives kind of linking up in quite a yeah. lucky kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I think a lot of people look for that collaboration, and maybe it's kind of a bit more like staring them in the face. Like, was there ever any point where you were both like, oh, I don't know how I'm ever going to do this?
Yes. Or... And then literally before every show we do it, we're like, never, no, we're never doing another one ever again. No way, it's too stressful.
But as soon as it happens, it's so exciting seeing that initial thought actually having turned into something real. It's so exciting that it totally makes it worth doing again, and suddenly, and for me the most exciting part is the initial stages when we've found a new space and thought of a new story.
Yeah.
So I'm always waiting for that next moment.
That is normally the moment where we sort of squeal and dance around, isn't it, when we find the space that,
yeah.
that we both really like.
When we saw the new space, the vaults, which is in Waterloo.
Oh, I love the vaults.
It's so good.
So cool.
I love the vaults so much.
It was just so exciting because it made it feel like this is where it's actually going to happen.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a good feeling.
It's amazing how when you find a space and you walk in, suddenly your ideas become real. Because before, you can talk about it for hours on end.
Yeah.
And it's only when you walk in and your mind goes, oh, that will go there and that will go there,
yeah,
and
yeah.
it all starts to...
No, and the vaults is a particularly good place for that because it's quite a blank canvas, you know, they strip everything out and you can bring pretty much whatever you want in on the, and they can bring things in for you. So
yeah.
It's quite exciting walking in there and seeing all the sort of very blank, staring concrete walls.
Yeah.
Or the leftovers from whatever the show was before.
But it's quite a good mixture of some rooms that are totally malleable for the performance we have in mind and others which stand alone as they are.
So we're currently sitting in a beautiful bar in Hoxton, so there may be a little bit of background noise from, say, people, the coffee machine.
Coffee grinding.
My boss will be past.
So... if the sound quality for this one isn't quite as clear, I do apologise. So as kids, did you ever like work together as siblings? Did you ever like...
Well, we played together.
Well, yeah, we ran shops, awesome. We ran endless businesses when we were little,
yeah.
We tales made out of cardboard.
Sold daffodils on the street.
Yeah. Inedible brownies and smelly perfume that we'd made in rosewater.
Where did you guys grow up?
In Norfolk.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah.
Sort
like
of about 5 miles
of
from the nearest post box.
I have to confess, I'm like such a London-centric person. I'm like, everyone grew up in London,
must have
which is so horrific, unless they have an accent where I'm like, you grew up overseas. That's exciting.
Yeah, we don't have, our Norfolk accents are slightly gone now.
I would never have paid you guys for Norfolk, but that. So what was it like, sort of, I guess, growing up in a quite an artistic family in Norfolk? Because that's quite idyllic, really.
It was. I think we were quite... I think that was one of the things that probably made us play that much and want to do something creative, is that if you live in a house which is miles away from other people, and the house is sort of generally, you know, there's a lot of dressing up boxes and nice things to do, I think you get quite... I mean, we didn't really spend that much time sort of in the village shops or something, did we? We spent quite a lot of time playing village shops at home.
Yeah.
Like creating things rather than... Which I think if we'd grown up in the city...
Definitely, we didn't have a TV half the year. We were really encouraged to be resourceful, and being bored was quite a fun thing to... I think Mum had this idea of it being sort of Enid Blyton childhood. Even though we just wanted to be listening to Spice Girls and wearing Lycra from Woolworths, it was definitely her dream to keep us with no... modern influences.
Yeah, wearing Hessian all the time. Hessian smocks and like barefoot and no electricity. Whereas, yeah, we were always sneaking off to watch Spice Girls, the movie. But it was lovely growing up in Norfolk. It was really, really nice.
Yeah. It was really nice to get that encouragement from an early age as well, to be able to, like, be creative. I think, well, I went the opposite way. My mum would, like, encourage me to, like, tone it down. So it's a bit over the top. Just sit down and watch Sesame Street, for God's sake. Stop
belly dancing.
That didn't happen till much later, but I was a bit of a rambunctious kid. So why did you decide to make that move to London? When did that come about?
Did you move to London before I did?
Yeah, I moved to London for my foundation year at Chelsea, which was when I was 18, and I've lived here ever since, with a year out in Paris and the circus.
I went to Glasgow University for a couple of years, and then when I left, I lived in Oxford for a bit working.
What did you study in Glasgow?
I did philosophy and theology.
Whoa, started on a joint heavy honours, stuff.
4-year course, yeah, heavy, heavy.
Different to circus?
Quite different.
Quite different.
Almost completely the other end of the spectrum. My dad used to joke that I'd just end up being a singing vicar. That was what my calling really was. But no, I didn't last very long there, because I'm really not built for academia, and I liked the South too much. I really missed... I just really didn't love Scotland. I think it was too far away from my family, in all honesty. And then I moved to London, so I moved after, like, just a couple of years after Kitty. But we didn't live together for a bit, and then now we're going to be living together. Well, we're hopefully going to be buying a house and living together. That's how... Oh, God. Oh.
So, Glasgow, not inspiring, not really your thing.
No, it was fun. Right. I did lots of singing and lots of music there and stuff, but it just rained too much. I think that was what it was.
How did you find the kind of arts scene in Glasgow?
It was pretty cool. There was a lot of... Because I'm also a singer, I used to do a lot of open mic nights, a lot of gigs, and there's a really, really good open mic night and gigging scene there. I actually didn't know at the time, but since I've started circus, I've met quite a lot of people who do circus in Glasgow.
Oh, cool.
I didn't know at all that there was a circus scene there, but the art scene there is amazing, absolutely amazing, like really, really cool.
Yeah.
Sort of wish I'd gone to the art school now, actually. Cause
yeah, but the one lot, that just burnt down.
The one that just burnt down.
Just
that
went up in flames, so cool. Oh my God.
I knew a lot of my friends from Glasgow were from the art school.
Yeah.
It's
really interesting because I also know someone who went to Glasgow Uni who's now an arty creative actor living in London, and they just couldn't get on with the atmosphere of Glasgow, but they appreciated the arts up there, but maybe didn't go to the right place in Glasgow for them. Mm. Seems to be quite a common thing, people going places because they think it's what they want, and then
actually what you want is you just want that thing but in a different place.
Yeah. Or you don't necessarily want that thing, but you're almost there, like, so close. You're so close to finding what you want.
Yeah,
I was quite lucky in that the university I went to gave me a lot of opportunities to work out exactly what I wanted, but also was, like, really, really close.
Yeah.
So that was... I feel very lucky in that sense. What about... Well, you're still studying.
Yeah, so I did one degree in graphic and spatial design, and now I'm doing illustration. But
why did you switch?
Because it was a two-year degree. And okay. I was supposed to do a third year to turn it into a BA, but decided that illustration suited me better. Sort of working with 3D, but in illustration, rather than working in a spatial course, and ended up trying to do 2D drawings. I felt like it was a better way around. But I really enjoy studying in London because there's so much you can get on with alongside studying. So I'm it's really great to have Tangerino as a way of, yeah, just kind of feeding off my projects at school. Definitely feed off Tangerino and vice versa. I feel like it keeps me very productive doing two things. That
sounds like a way you can almost like experiment with the ideas that you're learning about, like in an actual real
physical way. It is, yeah,
because
completely. Yeah.
I mean, we spent the last term making a publication, for example, and illustrating everything, and then making a program for the Red Shoes. It's exactly perfect practice in trying to do it.
Yeah. Under
a strict budget, and you know, do it all kind of like under.
So what did you do in your year out in Paris?
I worked at Vogue as an intern.
What?
Learned to speak French.
You worked at Vogue?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Was it good? Do you have any stories about Vogue that you may or may not be able to?
It was my perfect place to be. I mean, it was really, really fun opportunity, and I was so lucky to be there, but I was just terrified people were going to ask me what piece belonged to what collection from what season, and then have to translate that into French. It was terrifying. But it was quite fun to have an excuse to actually wear heels sometimes and dress up a bit and be a bit chicer. Like, firstly because of being in Paris, but also because of being in Vogue.
I'm going to be really ignorant and be like, was it at all like The Devil Wears Prada?
It kind
of
was.
That's probably a really ignorant question.
I think it sounded a bit like that.
I mean, there were guest editors, and sometimes that was the most terrifying moment because there were people from who were just terrifying.
you learn really good French though.
Yeah,
really, I definitely feel French.
It was really good for my French.
That's really.
I'm most jealous of that.
That time in Paris was really interesting because seeing the Crazy Horse totally sparked something in me for
it's quite like
the Moulin Rouge.
It's a cabaret venue
with such really an incredible beautiful. Light show. It's so beautiful. So there's girls lined up sitting upside down with a light show going over their legs. That's like just incredible.
Did you see Beyonce? There's like a new Beyonce video that came out with her where she had leopard print projected onto her, and it was basically her. That entire thing is a big ripoff of Crazy Horse. Like it's completely what there's
really
lots
cool
of sort of very identical dancers with beautiful projections on it. Yeah,
yeah,
it's very very Crazy Horse. That
that's really cool.
I'd love to go. You went, didn't you? And you were there.
Yeah, I did. It was really brilliant.
Sounds incredible. So that specifically, you're talking about the light show and like the legs, because you're about to do. We're about to do a show called The Red Shoes, based on the original fairy tale, and obviously it's about dancing and not being able to stop dancing in a large part. So was that image, is that something that stuck with you as an inspiration, or did that sit in the back of your mind at all? Or?
Well, when we liked the idea of using the red shoes, the Crazy Horse is what came to mind in terms of choreography, and also just a visual reference that we've noted and used quite often. But I think it's just, I don't know what about it. I mean, maybe the idea of having lots of feet in a row that dance together made us think about the way the show was formed.
It's also that, what's the French picture of the... of that really iconic picture of the legs inside the can-can skirt. You know, it's just a really...
A Lautrec.
Is it a Lautrec, maybe? Yeah, something like that. But, you know, it's a really sort of simple picture that tells you everything you need to know, really, about something. You know, legs with a skirt on, dancing.
Yeah.
You know, it's show, it's a good time, it's probably, you know, sexy, beautiful girls. But the red shoes is such an interesting thing to do because it's that, but it's also the other side of it. It's so much darker than that.
Yeah.
And we went to see Stephen Fry do an inaugural talk at St. Cat's in Oxford, and he was talking about being a performer is putting on the red shoes and not being able to, and choosing not to take them off. That's what it is, choosing to be a performer in an artist in any way, so an actor, a singer, a dancer, a producer, a director. You can't stop creating, and I think that was what appealed to me the most about it, was that it's just the notion of that you, once you start down the path of creating things artistically, then you can't really stop. Yes. And if you do stop, it's probably because somebody's cut your feet off or your hands off. You know,
yeah, it's almost inevitable.
You can't. There's only one way to, you know, it's sort of do or die. You do that, or you can't really be doing anything else, or you're miserable.
I think it's interesting as well to think of that as whether that's a blessing or a curse, because yeah.
It's quite ambiguous in the story, isn't it? Whether. Yeah. In the Hans Christian Andersen version, it's definitely, I think he is sort of slightly mocking the very sort of strict, I don't know whether it would be Presbyterian, but sort of quite strict religious small community, and they ostracise her for wearing these bright red shoes at her confirmation. And I think it is quite ironic, actually, I think, because in fact, she didn't really do anything wrong. She didn't know anything better. She just wanted to look beautiful and wear these shoes. So yeah, there is definitely two sides to it.
Dance, yeah.
Yeah, because she did the wrong thing, but also she's a child, and you can't really help but forgive her.
And also that drive to dance and to want to dance as well. They when I read the story, they never celebrated it. They never looked at her and never felt that was a positive thing. And it was almost like drawing a parallel, almost like Edward Scissorhands kind of story, where they ostracize the person for their difference. And
yeah,
I think that's such a resonant theme with, you know, because you say like the arts for anyone who's performing, and this we talked about this a bit in the last podcast about how, you know, you have like there's something in you that says you have to do it, and if you did anything else, it would be like someone had cut your hands and feet off. But then there's also that debate, particularly in our current economic climate, where people are like, why don't you get a real job?
Yeah, you know? Lots of that.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, well, I don't, you know, first of all, I don't have to get a real job. There's no hierarchy of jobs that says that this job is better than that job. It all depends on how you look at it. But it's also the idea that, like, well, if I did do that job, I did get that real job, and I was miserable, why is it any better than doing this one and being happy? It's kind of.
But I think also, I mean, it's not to say that this is any easier doing something creative.
The opposite.
Yeah. I mean, it's so much harder. I deal with the production rather than, well, as well as the creative side of it. But I mean, you're having to do a lot of jobs at once, actually, and take a lot more risks than if you. I think it would be easy to give in to a regular job.
Yeah, I definitely think that I could have easily have just had my act and not, and my life would probably, well, right now would probably be a lot simpler, because you just go out as a corporate act on your own. You only have to worry about yourself, you know, the risk of assessment form you have for your one act. You go out, you get paid a huge amount of money, and you go home,
yeah,
you know, performing for some banker's evening. Whereas this feels somehow more, I don't know, maybe this feels like slightly more of a real job, because we're trying to start a business that can employ other people and
a whole structure around what we're doing.
One of the things I liked about you guys was the fact that you are dedicated with this bigger production, now that you've decided you're expanding to a pub company, that you have been like, we want to pay you guys, we want to pay
our
performers, and that's something that I resonate with as well. I'm sure it's going to come up many, many times across many episodes in this podcast, but paying people for their talent. Like, I've started recently to look at what creatives do as if we were like a tech startup, but instead of dealing with technology, we are dealing with images or our physical bodies or our, you know, directing talent, our ability to manage people. I know, you know, it's so difficult to explain to people. They're like, oh, well, you just draw pictures. It's like, well, you know, how is that any different to someone fiddling with
but
numbers?
But it's awful if you're a performer and you go out and you work for a huge production company, television company, they will do everything not to pay you anything. Oh, it's good publicity. Oh, you're going to be on primetime television. And most of these performers are people who've either paid a huge amount of money for an education, or they've been doing it for 10 years with, you know, broken shoulders and busted knees and this and that, and still these huge television companies will say, come and do an advert for us, but, you know, do it for free because it'll be worth it. And in fact, it's really, really awful. I mean, it's just a really bad way to sell your industry down. So that's why we particularly want to make sure that we pay people. That's the most important thing, really, for us.
Particularly because I feel like the arts aren't valued by our current government in the UK. Getting a bit political for a second, the arts are seen as very much lesser, and that, you know, you're choosing to have a quote-unquote easy life. Whereas I think that it's completely the opposite, and people don't really place value on what an almost invisible place the arts have in our society, is something very integral to our expression as human beings. But on that note, can I tell you a story about, like, I heard it this morning and it's on this vein, and it drove me, I was so angry hearing this. This may not make it into the final cut of this podcast, but I just couldn't. So one of the reasons I know you guys is through circus. And I've been dabbling in silks for I don't know how long, and I'm still no good. But that's fine. I'm happy with that. Belly dance is my thing. Silks maybe will, in like 10 years' time, be my thing. But it's fun. But I'm in like a beginner improver class. And somehow this conversation happened where one of the girls in my class, who is very sweet, and I do not blame her, said something about a routine. And I went, oh, you're working on a routine. And she was like, yeah, I am. I was like, okay, who for? Oh, this festival. They asked me to do a 20-minute silks routine.
What?
But I can't practice every day. And I was like, are they paying you? And she said, well, they're giving me a free festival ticket. And if I'm good enough, they'll sign me up for future work.
God, that's so 20 awful.
20 minutes.
Yeah.
That's not even legal. No circus artist would ever do an act for longer than for six, seven minutes.
7 minutes.
You can't ask, especially Ariel.
Cirque du Soleil, Key Dam, I saw the incredible silks artist, Julie Cameron, I saw her perform. That act was maximum 7.5 minutes on the silks.
I mean, I've never seen an aerial act that's longer, a single aerial act where they don't come down that's longer than 8 minutes. I mean, it's like you'd get so pumped, you'd lose all grip. I mean, and that's the sad thing is that people who really want to do it, but who aren't knowledgeable about the industry in general, will go out for jobs where they'll be paid £100. And it's fair enough. Like, I think there's a bit of a, I mean, this might be a very contentious point to make, but there is a huge debate going on at the moment within my sort of small circus world, as in with the difference between circus and cabaret, and that a lot of cabaret performers will do a gig for £50, and that a lot of circus performers won't get out of bed for less than £200, and that there's a funny divide that happens. Whereas, in fact, I think that what we should all do is just say, God, I'll get out of bed for the right amount of money. Like, if I'm working for an hour.
But if you're undercutting each other, obviously, yeah.
But exactly, so there's a really difficult thing of, you've got somehow, obviously you can't because that's illegal and it's sort of wage fixing or whatever it is, but the more you accept work for free, the more you accept work for £50, the harder it's going to be for any circus performer to stand up and say hello, or any performer, dancer, anyone, musician, say, excuse me, I'm trained in this, I will not do it for £50.
There's part of me, because I've obviously accepted gigs for £50, we all do when we're starting out, but I can understand doing both as performing as a dancer and also dabbling in circus arts myself. I can understand why you would charge more for circus, purely because the amount of training that you need to go through to be able to be even possibly safe on your equipment and the rigging as
That is one of the most important things as well, is that if you're going out to do a job for somebody and they're paying you £40, generally, the space is probably not going to be very safe. Your rigging's probably not going to be very safe. You're probably not going to be given a very good space to warm up in. You know, I always think it's quite a good sign of whether the work is going to be good, whether they pay you enough, because it normally means that you have to get changed in a loo and you won't have time to warm up or warm down, and some of the scenery might fall on your head. And as a performer, your body is what you live off. So it's a really sort of,
it's a bit of a dangerous trade-off, really, isn't it?
I think it really is. It's too dangerous, definitely. Especially if I'm going to want to use my body to make money for the rest of my life. You know, it's going to be on my voice or whatever it is.
Yeah, and that's another thing. I mean, a lot of musicians are now protected by the Musicians Union, who demand that they command quite reasonable rates, which, like, is fair. But, you know, you always get open mic nights where people want to just try
that's
things.
But I think that's a totally different thing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
If you're up for saying, I'm coming here to sort of preview my act, or to try it out, which a lot of people do, they go to sort of cabaret nights or sort of, you know, beginner circus nights, and they'll try out their act, and I think that's a really good thing to do. But
yeah,
I do definitely think that it's tricky. It's a slippery slope to not, you know,
yeah,
to undercutting the arts to completely yourself and everyone else in it.
And I think that's also the same with people who are in design as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people can say, oh, can I just have this? Or can I just have that? And, you know.
Yeah, it's really hard. I guess it's just quite a difficult thing to measure, isn't it? People don't understand how... I mean, for me, an hour's work is very different, though, to an hour's work for a physical performer like you two. But it takes me for something that feels like a, you know, an A4 2D thing that I've produced. That could easily take me 30 hours, and that then has to cost £600. And people often don't understand that at all. And so, yeah, the hour thing is really important.
Yeah,
it's interesting the way we also treat like tangible objects as opposed to
an experience,
audio or visual performances, where, you know, there are people be like, oh, well, you can just do it, and be like, well,
yeah, that is funny. Isn't
whereas
it?
If you actually have an object
it,
to
keep it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so funny the way we kind of divide that in our minds.
Yeah, because you remember those things for so much longer, though, didn't you?
Yeah.
I mean,
unless you put something on your wall and then you'll see it every day.
But. Yeah, I never regret spending money though on a circus show.
A performance, I've always said this. Even the most sort of wobbly, terrifying, amateurish circus show is like one of my favourite things to watch ever. It's just sort of raw human activity. It's just, you know, somebody trying to balance on a, you know, on a globe ball, and sometimes it's hilarious, or a dog that won't behave, or whatever the thing it is. Like, I think circus is always entertaining, whatever happens. And it's the same with, to a certain extent, sort of bad gigs. It's the same thing.
So
you'll just know
a level
what it's like.
Of humor, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, to be
manageable. I mean, as a sort of audience member rather than a performer, I always find that's the one thing that salvages.
Or whether if it's funny,
basically.
Yeah.
I think, and
well,
I think
we could be laughing
we're finding
at it, though,
in our production at the moment is, you know, because it's quite a serious story, but circus has to maintain quite a lot of humour.
Mm.
It's quite a hard thing to try and interlace into, but I guess the way that, I don't know.
Luckily, our company is quite, I think most of us are quite sort of funny, quite open to it being funny.
At ease on stage as well.
And most of us have all performed and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so however serious some of the parts are, the funny bits weren't that hard to come by, really, actually, in the end. Especially Arthur.
Yeah. Oh, Arthur, bless him. Yeah. But that's one of the things, actually, that I took a professional course on devising and sort of adapting, which you guys have done. You've adapted the story for stage, and you've kind of broken it open and found the nuggets that are essential to the story but also interesting to you, and have kind of stuck it back together in a really fascinating way. But I was chatting to this company, and they said one of the main tenets is if you have a really dark story, the way in is to find the humour in it.
Yeah.
In order to work
to have
with
some
it.
Sort of contrast or some sort of
to find a
to
way
make it relatable maybe as well,
because we seem to relate to each other through humour in a really great way. Like, even just making friends, if someone can make you laugh, that you'll really remember them.
It creates a bond, doesn't it, straight away,
immediately.
No, and Luke Hallgarten, who is his assistant director on this, and one of my very, very close friends, he said that circus should start big and end bigger, and that even if you have a very serious story in it, you have to grab the audience's attention, and it can't just be sad, or it can't just all be one, you know, great big huge raucous, you know, thigh slapping laugh for an hour. Like,
that would get so tiring.
Yeah, exactly. You have to have the lights and shade. But so that's what Luke and I particularly spend a lot of time trying to work out how to find the light and shade in it, because it is underground, this show, so to a certain extent most of it is dark and the vaults are quite sort of damp, and I mean it's got
well,
those beautiful lighting
but in it do immediately make you feel quite kind of
you're a bit nervous, am I going to run out of air?
nervous in a good way.
Yeah, no, of course.
Immediately.
That's what we want, the audience to arrive and be a bit nervous, but what are they going to make us do?
Yeah, it's amazing when you walk into a space and if you feel a bit enclosed, already your senses are on that high alert.
Yeah.
And everything seems just a little bit more exciting. It's great. Yeah. So can we maybe talk about Giffords a little bit? Because obviously you mentioned that your aunt Nell runs a circus. It's quite, I would say, a well-known circus now in the UK. Circus has such a funny place in UK culture. It really does. But Giffords, run by Nell and Totti Gifford, is obviously where you guys first... Was it your first experience of circus, or did you see something else and then someone was like,
oh, go see? Other circuses before. That was probably our earliest experience of going to see shows.
Oh, cool. So you went to go visit...
Yeah, she worked
on
a big circus in Germany.
She worked for Roncalli. Yeah,
they're amazing.
I remember seeing that when I was probably about 9, about that age.
She worked for Santos as well, didn't she?
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because her, I mean, I would say that Giffords is pretty. I mean, most people you talk to, or somebody in their family, or somebody in the room, or somebody around the table has heard of it, because it's. It's quite singular. It's really unique, you know.
It's quite special. One of the reasons I was drawn to it, full disclosure, I did a season of working with Giffords, which was amazing. One of the reasons I was drawn to it was I'd seen a lot of UK circus before, and we will come back to it. And I am dual nationality, and I'd seen American circus as well. And there is a very, very stark contrast to me between UK and American circus. And then when I saw Giffords and not just their attention to individual acts, but show as a whole and the artistry of the entire experience, that's what really turned me on to it as an entity. It suddenly made me go, oh, they look at it as an art form. They don't look at it as a bunch of acts put together in a tent.
Yeah.
They look at it as an entire composite whole. They look at it as a full show, and that was exciting to see. So
yeah, and I think because that was our main initial inspiration, I think we would find it hard to set up a show that wasn't following that formula to a certain extent, just because it's exactly what we've loved about circus. It's the most familiar side of it for us, and it is so successful whether we look at it subjectively or objectively.
Yeah.
I like that formula, and it's what
no, we, I think I don't know how we could ever. I mean, so much of my experience of all of my experience really of circus is from Giffords. So, I mean, I don't think. I mean, you know, there really wouldn't be a Tangerine without Giffords Circus. Most of the things that we have learned about circus and how to do it, we'd learn from Nell and Totti. And sort of some of the business side from our parents as well. Mm. But I loved it. We've worked there since we were on and off, since we were little, sort of front of house.
For a week or two when we were younger.
Yeah, sort of in the summer holidays, go and sort of work in the box office. And it was just always the most exciting thing ever. Mm. Go and sort of camp in a tent for like 3 or 4 days. And it was just really fun.
Well, you didn't get one of the wagons.
Not when we were little. It was sort of even too exciting for that, wasn't it? It was just, I'll sleep in a car, I'll sleep anywhere. I'll sleep on the floor.
Just let me stay with
you. No, Nell always put us up in the sort of lovely B&B wagon or wherever. But it was just so exciting. It was always so exciting. It's always very, very busy. There's always so many people coming to stay there. They're really sort of generous and have a lot of friends and family there all the time. It's a completely amazing family place, Giffords. You go there for a day or a couple of days and you just don't want to leave. I worked there for a year. We both worked there for a tour, for a season. I never wanted to go. It was just amazing. That's why I joined the National Centre for Circus Arts. It was after I worked there for a year. The lovely hand balancer called Pat Bradford, who's sort of circus royalty.
Oh my god, Pat Bradford is a legend.
He's not a spring chicken, but he's been in circus for a long, long time, and he's one of the most amazing.
Isn't he like fourth generation circus or something? Yeah. Like his family goes way, way back, and
absolutely, and for generations,
gorgeous, angelic looking son, Anthony,
and he's a sort of beautiful dancer.
Also,
wife.
An incredible
lovely
oh, Kate.
Kate. He's a sort of Moulin Rouge. Was a Moulin Rouge girl.
She was a Moulin Rouge soloist. Oh, she was a like lead can-can dancer.
Absolutely.
Pat and Kate Bradford. Look them up. Your lives will be changed.
Most beautiful, well presented sort of uber circus couple you've
They're
ever
so
seen. They're so
pro.
But so I just asked him to give me some lessons in sort of, I didn't even know what to ask for at that point. I was like, can you just teach me some things? Yeah. So he taught me sort of a bit of aerial hoops, some sort of, I don't know, walkovers, sort of forced me down to the Spits for about a month. And after that, he just said, why don't you apply to go to a circus school? So I didn't really know what else I was doing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I really, he's been a huge influence on my life as well.
And Pat and Kate are so lovely. They're so parental. Like, I know they have.
They're
like,
everybody's parents.
Exactly.
At the circus,
like
yeah.
They have this beautiful child who is also like insanely talented and nice. But I would even sort of sidle up to them and be like, "Can you just teach me some tap steps?"
I know.
Would you because they don't just do incredible circus feats. They tap dance like Fred and Ginger.
They are amazing,
beautiful people. Yeah. Circus, you meet some of the best people, I reckon.
You make some of the most sort of strong relationships. You're going through some apps and some really, really, really fun times, really fun drunken times, but also some quite terrifying sort of hair-raising moments.
Yeah, well, just the whole... It is kind of true that image of the circus is both the most intensely beautiful and wonderful lifestyle, and then on the other side of it is...
It's living in a field, isn't it, really?
Rough.
Yeah.
Especially the year where I was...
It is hard graft.
2012 was so rainy.
Yeah. And you're living in mud up to your knees, aren't you?
And you're living in that. You're just living in it, but, like, it kind of all evens out in the end, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. It all comes out in the wash, really.
I think I still got some of us.
If you can get to a laundrette in the middle of your field.
I loved it. It was definitely one of the happiest years of my life working there.
So
absolutely.
That's that pursue towards it, sort of Pat's hinting.
No, definitely. But I wouldn't have thought I could do it unless somebody had said you could do it. Mm-hmm. And it was him. It was him and Nell.
Yeah.
Wow. And it was them who said, just go for it, you know. You're never going to know. And I didn't know about the circus space, which is what it was called at the time. It's now called the National Centre. But I didn't know about it, and they told me about it. And
you
I auditioned.
You didn't know about circus space?
I didn't know. I literally just didn't really know. I loved it. I loved going to watch circus, and I loved going to watch shows and music and stuff. But I just didn't really... I don't know. I just never really had the balls to do it, to go for it, to try it.
Yeah.
So I started when I was 22, which is relatively quite late to start performing.
People say that, like, I had this image that circus was something that you had to come to when you were, like, kind of like ballet, that you either had to come from a family or you had to, like, get into it really young to be amazing. Yeah. But actually, looking at a lot of the performers now, if you have the dedication, you have the drive, you
have something interesting that you want to do.
Yeah, and everyone's different. I mean, there's, you know, that's what... We had a discussion about Cirque du Soleil today at class, Silk class today as well, about how... It's all about kind of like individual differences between performers. Everyone brings something else to the table, and I think that's one of the amazing reasons the arts could benefit from removing that idea of competitiveness from it.
For sure, and I mean, that's what we wanted to do really with this show, was to have a dancer. You know, we wanted to have a real mixture of, you know, we have artists, we have like sort of illustrators and so people doing live animations. We were trying to mix it, all the visual arts as much as possible, into one space under one sort of loosely fitting narrative, so that there isn't, it's not sort of two gymnasts doing the same thing and competing for better marks, you know.
Yeah, they're helping each other instead of competing against each other.
Yeah.
To go off on a circus-y tangent, sorry Kitty, I'm sure we'll come back round to some more. Coming back.
Sorry.
Where did
circus,
I go?
Circus.
I wanted to know about Circus Space. So you went to Circus Space. Used to be known as Circus Space, now has been rechristened and reopened as the National Centre for Circus Arts.
That's it.
How have you found that? What's it like?
It's amazing. It's really, really hard work, really... sort of the most amazing group of teachers and students. I mean, it's relatively small, so there's about 20 people in each year. There are 3 years. It's a BA. It's linked with the University of Kent, So you have to sort of write essays as well, and you have supporting classes. So you do, you also do ballet and contemporary movement, and you do acrobatics and trampolining and handstands, and you do a lot of supporting classes. But then in your second year, you specialise. You choose a specialisation.
So what's your specialisation?
Mine is seer wheel.
That's so cool.
It's like a single. It's sometimes called simple wheel. Sometimes called Rusier. It's like a single German wheel with no handles, no bars. You just stand inside
it. So is the German wheel the one with
German wheels,
wheels,
double
handles,
wheel, yeah, with,
and bars?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the one I've normally seen, but recently I've been seeing seer wheel, which is just a single metal hoop.
Just a hoop, yeah, exactly.
That you hold on to.
You put your, you stand inside, and
if you imagine that Leonardo da Vinci image where he's
Vitruvian
inside,
man,
exactly, the Vitruvian man, where there is a person inside a circle.
That's
what seer wheel looks like, except it's three dimensional at the hoop, and it's like
It's pretty cool. It was invented.
It defies the laws of physics.
It's like a really new circus discipline. I think that's partly why I find it so exciting. Is because of its. I mean, there's pictures of sort of Egyptian women doing things inside a wheel, but it hasn't really been given any credence until the 1980s, really 1990s, when a guy called Daniel Seer invented the seer wheel. I mean, up until then, it's sometimes had handles on it, it's sometimes had other stuff, but it, and then so recently it started to become a thing that you see. When I started doing it a year ago, it took a long time to explain to people what it was. Now, the more I talk to people about it, much more people seem to know, oh yeah, I've seen somebody do that, oh yeah, I saw somebody doing that on the beach, or I saw somebody doing that in Soap Today. It's a new thing, so it's really fun. And
I've definitely seen German wheel before.
Yeah, no, German wheel's been around for
a while.
And it's a gymnastic discipline, German wheel.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and but Sia's just been introduced into the Wheel Olympics.
Because
last,
if you've got one thing with handles,
years.
Why not take them away and make
exactly.
it harder?
Make it way harder. But that's why, partly why, for me, partly why we're putting on this show is because I'm at school with like, sort of, well, my year is 20 really amazing, talented young people who are learning how to do something. We're all learning together, doing sort of quite terrifying, soul destroying sort of clowning classes where you sort of have to stand up on stage and be funny. Just be funny. And it's terrifying, but it's really exciting to do.
A friend of mine's at the Gollier School in France.
Scary.
And the story she tells me, I'm like, well, I am never going to be a clown. I'll tell you that. That is way harder than like climbing up, you know, 6 meters in the air, wrapping myself in some fabric and then just letting go.
I know, people always assume that the sort of trampolining and the silks are going to be the scary thing, but actually the clowning and the sort of performance part of it is quite a lot harder, because you have to really let yourself go. You have to let go of all your inhibitions and just be silly on stage, basically. But it's amazing. It's a really, really amazing opportunity, and the audition process is just 2 days of sort of an assault course, a presentation. They see if you can hold a ball, catch a ball, you know, stand on one leg. It's all relatively, they're just looking for potential.
How fit were you when you applied?
Not particularly. I really wasn't. All they were looking for
you
was potential.
You had done a whole season, though, if you think about it, of sort of dancing in two or three shows per day.
No, I hadn't been sort of sitting on a sofa, but I hadn't been going for a run or doing any sit-ups or anything. I'd just been generally active for a year, yeah. But
have you been trained in like dance or anything before?
Never done anything else like that before. I mean, I tried to do tap and ballet when I was little, but I think I just got bored of each one in turn, moved on to the next thing, which I wish I had. Really, really regret.
Finally,
that,
circus has captured your attention.
Finally, at a ripe old age of 22, I decided actually that's what I like to do.
I can't believe that's considered old.
No, I mean it's not old, but it probably took me a year longer than it took everybody else to get flexible. You know, because if you start that when you're nine, that's much easier, and you can get box splits almost immediately. Whereas if you start trying to get box splits when you're 22, that is painful.
I know. I started when I was 20, and I still don't have them.
I think my hips just don't work that way. That's why I keep telling my flexibility teacher. My hips don't open like that. I've got those special hip sockets.
Just achieved chest on the floor from not
from legs, just straddle. Like 90,
just from straddle, just for sitting on a straddle on the floor. I've just achieved chest on the floor.
That's a good, it's like, a great achievement, well done.
Oh,
it's good.
Thank you.
It's good.
Thank you.
It's good for your lower back, that.
I see people who can just do it, and I just sit there going, so many years of my life.
Horrible people who are annoyingly just flexible, just naturally flexible.
Like beautiful Claudia.
Like the amazing Claudia in our show, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. There's an incredible contortionist who is not only insanely talented, but also is one of the sweetest people I've ever met, I think.
Oh, she's sweet.
Just so sweet.
And she's doing
chatting to you guys has been amazing, getting a bit more of a handle on what you love about circus. Yeah,
I love it.
Although Kitty runs away, I might ask you a bit more about circus in the UK. That's all right. We've been making references throughout this whole podcast to this show that is going to happen next week. It's going to happen on Tuesday the 22nd, mm-hmm. Wednesday the 23rd, and Thursday the 24th of July at 7:30 p.m. in the Vaults in Waterloo in London. Just in case anyone from overseas is possibly listening. And it's called The Red Shoes, which is a fairy tale by Hans Christian Andersen, but you guys have been inspired by it and made it into something quite special. So let's hear a bit more about that.
So basically we have adapted the story of The Red Shoes into five themes, which are pride, vanity, guilt, condemnation, and redemption. And within those five themes, we've chosen a circus act, a different musical instrument, a musician, and an artist. And they collaborate, the circus performer and the musician, to devise a piece to do with that theme within the Red Shoes story. And alongside the show, there's an exhibition where artists have done the same response to their specific theme. So that's how the whole evening exists.
And we're really lucky with this new space because there are multiple rooms. So we thought we'd sort of push the boat a bit, really out of our comfort zone, and have a go at making it sort of part promenade show. Mm. So one of the acts happens in a different room, and trying to give too much away, but it's been a completely different actually creating this show than it was to the other ones because of how much space we had actually, and because we started a bit earlier, and because we had slightly more performers and slightly more musicians and artists than we did last time. So it's actually really exciting. And
Show, The Ugly Duckling, was like this sort of small, everyone kind of wanted to get together and try out some stuff and make an exciting night of performance. So you sort of put a story to it within that, whereas this one you've consciously said, actually we like the story and we want to bring people in to fit this story.
Yeah.
And kind of come at it from a slightly different direction. And it's also like quite large scale. And your Kickstarter was amazingly successful.
Yes.
Which was awesome.
So good. That was
thank
so
you,
kind of everyone.
People.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you to everyone who donated.
It's so made cool. It possible. I mean, it is really exciting because it means we can just do that little bit more, like hire an aerial rig, which we've got, because we've got a rope artist, and just have a sort of slightly more budget to make beautiful costumes.
And for lighting and sound, we haven't got a budget. But to have budget for lighting and sound was something that we were just relying on what the space had before, rather than being able to think through some actual conscious decisions rather than just being resourceful.
Yeah, a lot of it's been a real steep learning curve, as we do each of the shows. We learn very, very quickly. Oh gosh, we probably should have got a quote for the lighting beforehand and things like that.
Oh, lighting is a sneaky one.
It is a sneaky one. It really is.
Yeah. And also, like you said, also going to paying talent as well, which is great, being able to... Because really when you ask people to do things for you, it's very different to people saying, oh, I want to try something out.
Yeah.
I have help, like, can you help me? And maybe help me find some space.
No, we started with that. Like, the first show that we did last year was just saying to our friends, look, we're going to rent a space, there'll be an audience. You know, we found some musicians, we wonder if you could create an act vaguely to the tune of this, and you know, and it sort of, they did it for nothing, and then the next time we said we would pay people as much as we could with whatever profit we made, and amazingly we broke even and made some profit. We managed to pay everyone, you know, enough to buy themselves dinner, not a huge amount.
Yeah.
And so this time we've specifically budgeted that in, paying all the performers a decent wage, and that's something that's really important for us, because we're going to try and create a company that is going to, you know, make shows that then the performers are really, I mean, you can't do it without them. And
yeah,
I just think it's really important that.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, and also there's no reason they would turn up when you were rehearsals ever if we weren't paying them a little bit of money. So it's practical as well as ethical.
This is true. It does help. You feel like
a little bit.
You should turn up and give your all if you're actually getting paid for it. So I want to finish this little segment, and then maybe we'll have a quick chat afterwards with this sort of dual-sided question that I like to ask at the end of every podcast, which is, and I know you've both been on stage in some capacity, what is the best thing that's ever happened to you on stage, and what is the worst thing that's ever happened to you on stage?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Kitty?
I don't know. So, best thing. My memories of being on stage are from so long ago. I played a mummy in a play when I was about 12 and got wrapped in tissue paper.
Is that good or bad?
That was a good one,
I don't know. It was probably my most key role. I sung We're Walking in the Air when I was quite chubby and 11 in the village hall. I think they're all not necessarily good or bad.
Never had any particularly embarrassing moments on stage.
Both of them, yeah.
We'll say they're both best and worst. What about you, Lil?
God, I don't know. I think worst moments on stage are always falling out of the wheel, always. Like, I performed a couple of times and coming out of the wheel, that's because you can't style that out. That just, it happens, and the wheel bangs to the floor and you fall out. That's happened a couple of times. The best thing.
Have you been severely injured in that instance?
No, never. Just embarrassed, you know.
Yeah. Pride hurt more than physicality.
Yes, exactly. I don't know what the best. I think maybe. Well, the best thing was probably the last. Tangerino event, the Ugly Duckling that we did, when we were on stage at the end of the second night, and I just felt so immensely proud and just completely flabbergasted that we'd actually managed to make a show that had sold out for two nights and in sort of amazing but very, very tucked away location in Brixton. That was probably my sort of best favourite moment on stage.
That's awesome.
That was probably it.
It's so great when your dream is actually real and physical and it happens. And there are people there and they're clapping.
And they're clapping, I know. It was lovely.
They're not looking at you going, what have you just done?
Yeah, that's always a relief.
I know Kitty has to dash off, so thank you so, so much for coming to talk to us about your amazing experience as an emerging artist in this crazy world of performance and visual arts. So I will let you
thank you, really nice to talk to you too.
Yeah, have a lovely rest of your day.
I'll see you later.
It's such a nice day, it's really hot right now.
It's boiling.
All sweating buckets. So, Lil, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about, obviously, as a circus artist who's about to graduate and move into the, well, I don't know if you've got more plans to keep studying, but obviously you're kind of working in the real world at the moment. How are you finding your response to circus? Is it changing or is it
totally completely? But I mean, having said that, I'm a newcomer. I really am a newcomer, so I really only know what's been going on in London in the circus sort of scene for the last 2 years. And I don't know, for me, the most encouraging thing is that people are starting to know that there's more to circus than Cirque du Soleil, because I think that's, obviously still for a lot of circus performers, that is the pinnacle of your performing career.
Yeah.
But I've also spoken to a lot of people who've performed for that and say it's quite soulless, you know, you live in hotels and you know, it's not, you don't get on with this giant company.
It's amazing how, I don't want to knock Cirque because it's done so much to change the image of circus.
Oh my god, yeah. I mean, it made it famous,
yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
Also, when I was a kid, it was like Cirque du Soleil or Zippo's, and they were kind of like the big circuses you knew about in the UK.
Mm.
But then I've got American parents, so my experience was Big Apple Circus and Ringling Brothers.
Right,
who
is big time, yeah.
Oh my god, I love them.
Yeah.
I love them so much. Especially Big Apple. There's something about Big Apple Circus that just like warms
my
heart.
I just think the British circus is sort of...
It's almost like...
It's trying to catch up, but it's doing it in a different way.
Yeah. Which is bizarre, because circus, like, started in England, like, as an art form.
With Philip Astley, yeah.
Yes, like, the art form of circus originated in the UK, and it almost seems like other countries were
They just sort of did it better, didn't they, to start with. I think that's what happened.
That's a great idea, let's make it better.
Let's do it better.
We all kind of fell behind and sort of went, oh, circus people, they're gypsies.
Well, it's sort of really odd, because it changes, it goes in fads. So in the last sort of year or... French circus was the sort of the really cool thing. That was what was in, and because it was sort of quite ironic and quirky and dry, and
they still have some of the best clowns.
No, absolutely. So. But now there's the sort of
mime history.
Yeah,
the French mime.
But I think the French aren't. I think French circus is not very good at taking the Mickey out of itself. And so there's an odd thing sometimes when you go, I don't know, I think British circus is really good at that.
Yeah.
At the funny side of it. And when you watch, I went to see Lemwet, which is, they're a brilliant French Canadian company, I think. Mm-hmm. I might be wrong about that. But I went to see them and they were great. But there's a funny thing of when they sort of do a trick wrong, they don't acknowledge that, yeah, and they just get up and do it again. And it's just sort of the same thing with Cirque du Soleil, I think, is that there's not really much room for error in that swanky circus.
Well,
British circus is sort of quite cool like that. There's a lot of emerging really cool companies that are really...
And the other country that has really been emerging that I've seen in the last sort of year and a half, couple of years, is Australia. Australian circus.
Well, they've got a huge, amazing circus school. You see Circa and A Simple Space.
Mm-hmm.
They're all from this sort of the same school. They're in the same school. And yeah, it's really cool.
There's another small company that I saw that I loved called Cassis, who did a show called Knee Deep.
Yeah.
And they're Australian, and that just like, it's one of the most beautiful things I've seen recently. In that, it was a company of four, and it was really heartfelt and heartwarming and had humour and was quirky and very touching. And
would you go, like, because I just think since I've moved to London, the South Bank is just... I mean, I could just spend a week there seeing a different show every night, seeing some cabaret, some stand-up, some circus. Some,
well, right now, because the London Wonderground thing is going on with the Spiegelturn.
Yeah, if anyone goes and sees, because the National Centre Third Years are doing their ensemble show in the Spiegelturn.
Yeah.
Top. I went to see it last night. It was really beautiful, and some incredibly sort of brilliant and innovative circus going on.
Oh yeah, actually I want to get Michael Standen on the podcast, because I met him at a cabaret last year, and he's such a sweetheart, and
he'd be perfect. Yeah,
we had a quick chat and I'd love to chat to him,
because he was in the Ugly Duckling.
Yeah, oh, was he? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, because he said he knew you. Yeah. We had a little chat about that.
Yeah,
I want to get him on this podcast.
Yeah,
he's on my wish list. I have a little wish list. Yeah, but it's interesting how it's almost like circus is experiencing a renaissance in this country. And it's also drawing inspiration from other art forms, like your company Giffords, and then all these foreign companies are coming in and showing their work. And
there's a lot of, and actually the National Centre for Circus Arts, my school, is doing a really, really cool job of churning out companies, like really good companies.
Mm.
There's a company called Membra, who are a brilliant circus company.
Oh, yeah.
They're really amazing. And Lena, one of the founding members, she just directed our ensemble show. She's an amazing woman. And there is Collective and Then, who are some two girls who started, but I think that's actually a bigger group than that. They do Devil's Crowd. They're absolutely brilliant. And then there's Silver Lining, who's an amazing company.
Yeah.
They were on at the
Roundhouse,
and in the hat. What was it called? The bowler hat, festival, London Festival. And then there is Circulus, who everybody knows about really from their massive video of all of us doing circus stuff in a warehouse in Limehouse.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. But it's just, our school is very, very good for not just churning out just acts, but people who want to be part of a company, that we want to start their own company, which I think is really,
because it's also it's almost symptomatic of the course, because you're gathering 20 odd artists together, and everyone loves collaborating. Like, it's, as an individual performer, it's one of the loneliest things, I think, making something by yourself. God, it can be one of the most amazing, but it's very, very lonely. This is one of the reasons
And you don't have any point of reference for somebody. You know, you can't tell yourself that you're being rubbish. So creating with somebody else.
Oh, yes, you can. That's the problem. Oh, really? You can tell yourself you're being rubbish all the time.
I find it's always the opposite.
You never tell
yourself I've got no idea whether this is any good or not.
That, well, that's the thing. Yeah. I err on the side of rubbish.
I'm probably on the side of arrogance then, that's what it is. No, I don't mean that.
Well, but then I'll cobble somebody over, yeah, it's fine.
This is fine.
Yeah, and then I wonder why I'm like, oh, this isn't getting the good reception I hoped it would. It's probably because I didn't work on it enough. It is tough though, when you're creating in isolation, so much creativity involves other people. So when you have a ready-made set of 20 odd people who you see on a near daily basis, who are also creative and work in your industry, that is helpful to bring you together like that.
And it's funny because you sort of, to a certain extent, you've learnt the same thing as those people in your year. You've been through the same classes, even if you've done a discipline, you've done the same ballet class, the same movement classes, the same rhythm and musicality classes, the same everything, theatre classes. And so there's a funny thing of you just can make a really great cohesive company that works really well together, like however big or small.
Sounds like a really comprehensive performance education,
it's amazing. We study the theory of it, we do a lot of history, we do a lot of we have to learn, we sort of go back and we have to write essays on, we have to write a post-structural analysis of a show that we've seen, or a postmodern analysis of a ballet that we went to see. They really make you think about it, and I just think they make you into a really well-rounded performer. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for learning circus on your own and learning it as a trade that you've learned from your family. I totally agree with that as well, but for me, somebody who's come to it quite late on, being given all the backstory, I need all the help I can take, and National Centre is just really, really
great
for that.
Getting all that information, composite,
and all those links, and it's in London, and most of the teachers there are still performing, or have just recently stopped, and so you just get a really well-rounded education from about everything, about what you should be paid. You know, you get lectures from past students or from professionals who come in and say, this is how you should present yourself, this is how you write a CV, this is
how you send an email,
this is how you should always talk to her, this is how you should dress, this is how you should, all stuff that is sort of common sense, but actually it's really, really amazing thing to learn.
Yeah, and otherwise you just have to ask some professional, be like, hi, can we sit down for a coffee?
Exactly,
tell me all the things you should actually know, please help me.
Which is great, but
it's nice that that's their focus as well. It's not just making you into incredible sort of Olympian style performers, but it's actually teaching you about the industry and about artistry. That's important, and that's really cool. So I guess if you want it all quickly and all in one composite place, and you want an intensive way of learning, I think that's a great way of being able to do it.
Definitely,
that's fantastic.
I agree.
So it's making me jealous now, it's making me want to go. But
no, you could, everyone should go. You can do you can do evening classes, you can do adult classes.
This is true.
Yeah, they teach you, you can go and you can do a course, you can pay for a course and do sort of aerial acrobatics, trampoline, handstands, it's a really, really great thing to do in the weekday evenings.
Yeah.
And then Saturdays and Sundays they have like tops and tiny tops and youth circus, so like you can go and
it's accessible.
Hold a juggling ball from the age of 9 months, I think it is. I mean, you can be pretty tiny. No, maybe it's what? Maybe you have to be over one. Anyway, but you can come with your baby and go and sort of sit on the bouncy acro room floor.
Yeah,
if you want to.
That's cool.
That's what you're into.
Yeah, fancy. That's very cool. It's nice that even if you're not doing the full time intensive course, there are options out there for people who maybe don't have the money to do a circus degree, because it is independent, and I don't know necessarily if you can get loans for that kind of thing.
No, I mean, I don't think you can. You have to be in full time education. I mean, there's lots of amazing places. There's a place called Gravity.
Yep.
Which Yam Doyev runs. Yep.
And there's
and
aircraft.
Leo as well, an aircraft circus, and
they do
Hangar
a foundation
Trust.
Course. Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of really brilliant, brilliant places. I mean, National Centre's sort of given itself a bit of a revamp and has made itself I mean, it just, you know, it used to just be a giant electricity power station covered in pigeon shit that they knocked holes in the wall so they could put a petit volant, you know, grand, yeah. and a flying trapeze rig in it.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of got more and more money. So really it's exactly the same as, you know, all those other places, the hangar and stuff. It's just had slightly more money behind it than they have.
And it's great that these circus schools are also springing up, not just in London, but they're all around the country. So if anybody is listening to this and is interested in actually beginning to learn circus, and it's one of the most exciting things I think I've ever done, is deciding I want to start climbing some fabric and falling out of it very gracefully.
Giving yourself awful burns.
Oh,
yeah.
God, I have one on the back of my knee right now.
I've got so many. They're really, really not
painful.
Nice.
Painful.
Yeah.
Yeah, circus is painful. No one tells you that before you decide to do it. The artists make it look so simple and beautiful, but actually you get covered in bruises and burns. So maybe I've just put some of you off. But do research circus in your area if you're really inspired by this, because there are so many ways to learn, and you don't just have to do an intensive course. You can do evening courses, and you know, you can
do a summer camp. There's a Cornwall thing called Cornwall Circus Camp or something like that, and
Greentop in Sheffield, and Circa Media in Bristol, and there's stuff up in Scotland. Yeah. Like, there's stuff springing up all over the country as popularity for it increases, which is great. Or, you know, maybe you want to travel overseas and learn overseas and do that kind of thing. But it is one of those art forms that is brilliantly still accessible. It's not like ballet where you have to kind of...
But it's sort of, somehow people think it's not accessible, but it is so much more accessible.
Mm.
You can come in any form, in any state, at any age, and pick something up.
One of the amazing things about it is, like, yeah, a lot of people think you have to be like incredibly flexible, age 5, and be able to put your legs over your head to be able to do this kind of thing. And
you really don't.
As long as you have, it takes a lot of dedication, and sometimes your body is in so much pain and you have burns everywhere, and you don't want to climb up and make more. But
that's the best feeling. I'm never as happy as I am when I wake up and I can barely get out of bed, barely straighten my arms and legs, because I just know that I'm doing something brilliant and hard and difficult, really pushing my body to its limits.
Yeah.
Obviously not that far, but yeah, to its limits. And I love that feeling. Yeah. It makes me feel alive and know that I'm really like making the most of everything in life.
There's something like when you pull off something that's particularly hard or terrifying, when you walk out of the room after that session, you're just like,
you can't explain that feeling.
I win!
And you sort of want to shout it as you're walking down the street, and sort of Seven Sisters on the way back from the glass. Do you know, I just did meat hook to meat hook, you know, nobody would understand what you meant, but it's just like, that was really good. That was what I just did was really good.
I just did a star roll from really high up. You don't know how good it was.
I know. There's nothing beats that feeling.
Like, star roll, is that sushi?
It's a drop. I mean, it's quite a complicated drop.
It's very, very complicated. It's not a beginner drop at all. It's not one of the most simple setups I've ever seen at all. it's great. So it's turned into a bit of a psycho stuff. So Lil and the now absent but still very much appreciated Kitty, where can we find you out in the world? So website, email.
Okay, so the website is tangerino.co.uk, and you can follow us on Twitter, which is Tangerino Events, at Tangerino Events.
Tangerino is spelled TANGERINO,
like tangerine but with an O on the end instead of an E. At Tangerino Events. Actually it's next week or something. It's scary.
Yep, next week.
22nd, 23rd and 24th of July at the Vaults underneath Waterloo Station on Leek Street. Come and see our show, The Red Shoes. It'll be really exciting. It'll be live. We've got live bands at the end of every night, as well as the live music during the show. And there's a bar, and it's a really exciting space. So come and see us.
And the end of it is very much like pulling the audience in.
Exactly.
Getting them all excited.
We may even
make
you do a little dance at the end. Not if you don't want to, obviously. We can't force you to.
We can encourage you.
Yeah.
Very much to do a very fun, very simple
Forcefully
little dance.
Forcefully encourage you. No. Please come. Don't be deterred by that.
It's really exciting, and it's not like any other circus show I've ever really seen or been a part of before. So it's an exciting thing to be able to do, and you'll catch me sitting in a corner creepily playing the violin.
Really.
Thank you so much for taking time to chat to me about all
My
things
pleasure.
Circus and arty, and how amazing and difficult but also fantastic and rewarding it is to be an artist in the world today, defying all the genres like a superhero. I have been your host, Rosie Cole. You can find me at rosiecole.com. You can find me on Twitter at rosie_cole. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/ Rosie Cole Dancer, or one word, or you can email me in the link on the blog under the podcast, or directly at rosiecoledancer@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and if you have anything you want to say, you have people you want to see, you have topics you want me to cover, please send me an email. I would love some feedback. Have a great day. Thank you so much. Bye.